When it comes to AI in fishing, I don't think those are two things that us anglers often put together. But in the modern world in which we live, this disruptive technology is going to change everything that we know about fishing in a lot of different aspects. But one aspect that I think is one of the coolest and most innovative and probably the most promising way that we're going to be able to use AI is in conservation. And so tonight I am joined by Dr. Nathaniel Hitt. He is a research fish biologist at the USGS, Eastern Ecologic Science Center, and he has developed an AI that's going to, in my opinion, in his opinion, in a lot of people's opinion, and I think it's inevitable, revolutionize fish conservation for the foreseeable future, I mean forever. And so enjoy this show. I mean, this is some really fascinating stuff, guys. It's some really kind of high-level conversation that we have here, but take some notes, listen up. I think this is going to be big stuff moving into the future, and I am so very excited to introduce Dr. Nathaniel Hitt. The Alex Rupp Fishing Podcast is powered by X2 batteries. If you demand the most out of your battery, whether it's lithium or AGM, whether you're in a kayak or a boat, you need to check out X2 Power Batteries, making the best batteries in the business and keeping up with all the demands that us as anglers have while we're out on the water. Go to x2powerbatteries.com to check out the full battery selection.
Yeah, baby. Wonder if all my bad decisions get accounted in the algorithm. No statistician could dissuade me from my bigger vision. I know my occupation's quite an unlikely place in this world to occupy and talk about upon a daily basis. Our information's predetermined by some biased business. We island sermon to Silicon that push out lovely neighbors. I'm done with paper chasing, think I'm on to bigger banquets. Miss that full circle, new wave, energy on a
Ladies
Tuesday,
and gentlemen, here we are. Another Friday Night Live, another podcast. I am, as I always say, and I say this every single podcast because I really do mean it, I am so excited about tonight's guest. And the reason I'm so excited about tonight's guest is really simple. So a few weeks ago, went down to Houston, Texas for the Berkeley Science Symposium. And, you know, while I was there, I kind of knew what was going on. We were releasing some new baits. We had the Kredge and we had the Finisher. And, you know, we're going to talk about forward-facing sonar. And we were going to talk about, you know, Berkeley Fish Science. But there was this one little thing on the agenda. And it said AI and fishing. And I was like, that sounds like something that's going to be entertaining and I can't wait. Well, then little did I know, do I get on the bus with a guy, and this guy's sitting behind me on the bus on the way from the airport, and, you know, we're talking fish biology and we're talking fish conservation, and little did I know that he hold a doctorate in all of those things, and that he was a lot smarter than I was. And then I found out he was a lot smarter than I was, and I was like, yeah, I got to get this guy on the podcast, and I've got to learn something from him. And so here is the man himself, Dr. Nathaniel Hitt, right? Did I say your last name correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
That's right.
So, go ahead.
Alex, I thank you so much. You know, the only thing you got wrong is that I'm not smarter than you, but other than that, you're perfect.
Bro, I can promise you, you probably are. Listen, there may be some things that I know how to do better than you, but when it comes to smarts, I got a feeling the guy with the doctorate might be a little bit smarter than me. Just maybe.
I appreciate you having me, for real.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, yeah, for real. I'm glad
that was an amazing meeting out there. You know, it really did blow my mind. I mean, what a cool venue, right?
Absolutely.
We were at NASA. It's rocket science. Yeah. Wow. No, yeah. It was really cool. Great venue out there.
Yeah, that was cool, man.
Do you remember that exhibit? I snapped a photo of this thing on my phone. Here's my daughter, by the way.
Oh, look at her.
I snapped a photo of this exhibit out there. It was the first night we were hanging out.
Yeah.
It was that one of the Apollo missions. I forget which number, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the Apollo missions, their backup plan was a Texas Instruments little, you know, calculator.
Yeah.
About this big.
Yeah.
I looked at that and then took a picture of it. And I was like, you know, this tells it all, right?
Yeah.
That was only 50 years ago. That's not that long ago. I forget which Apollo mission this was, but this was their back. And this was the best technology.
Yeah. It's crazy, man. It's crazy.
It's like, boom.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
So, yeah.
It's
let's
crazy.
Talk about it. Yeah. That's
absolutely
cool.
Dude. Yeah. No, Houston was cool. And what was really cool, Space Center was amazing because I'm a science nerd. So a little bit about me. I don't know. We never didn't really get a chance to know each other, but a little bit about me. I used to be an educator. Used to be an elementary educator. So I was an elementary school teacher before I did content full time. And science and history were my two favorite subjects to teach. And I love to teach science, and I love to get hands on with my kids. And so when I was in the Houston Space Center, I was walking around like a kid myself because it was just I was having so much fun. And the thing that blew my mind the most was I didn't realize how big a freaking rocket was. Like, dude, we walked in that hangar with the Apollo rocket, and I was like, oh my God, this is so much bigger than I ever could imagine that it was. And then I got to thinking about it, kind of like you. I'm like, we did this in 1969? Like, wait just a second. Like, that doesn't make any sense. And then, I don't know if you saw it, but there was a little plaque, and it talked about from the time that the Wright brothers flew the first plane to the Apollo mission was only 70 years. And I was like, that makes no sense at all. But then you think about the leaps and bounds that we've made in technology up to this point, and it's like, I can kind of see that we're now hitting an exponential, we're hitting the exponential part of the graph where it just goes skyrockets and we don't stop it.
Well, that is interesting. Yeah, that is the same deal, man. I saw the same thing out there. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's true. There's a lot of hype, you know. It's AI, hype. Well, we should talk about, you know, what we can do with AI to actually do fisheries management and conservation.
Absolutely. Sure. Let's do that. Before we do that, I want to let you introduce yourself because you are I will say it, even if you won't say it about yourself, you're a very impressive human, my friend. I was reading up on some of the all your degrees and all of the projects that you've worked on and research that you've done, and you are an impressive human. So just give everybody a brief kind of, you know, explanation of who you are.
Yeah. So I grew up in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. You know, deep roots out here. I'm doing fisheries biology. It's population, community, but we're trying to do fisheries biology that's relevant for management conservation out here in the Eastern Ecological Science Center. Mm-hmm. It's a USGS research station. It's a federal research station, the US Geological Survey. Mm-hmm. So I can talk about that later on. I did my PhD work in Virginia Tech. Mm-hmm. Did some time out in Montana too, University of Montana, for my master's work.
Yeah.
And these places really, I mean, it was really the people, it was the fisheries for sure, you know, and the landscapes for sure. But it was some people along the way that really, shaped me and pointing in the right direction. You know, we have to have mentors like that. Mm-hmm. And, undergrad, College of Worcester, Ohio, you know, so I've been around the place. Met my wife in Costa Rica.
There you go. Awesome.
We're doing a SFS, School for Field Studies, thing out there.
Yeah.
So, but circled back around to Appalachia. So, you know, I left Morgantown, grew up in West Virginia, kind of circled big old loop, and landed back in West Virginia, which I'm really happy about. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, grew up in the Monongahela National Forest, getting the big woods out there, fishing brook trout streams, there's so many, but up in the mountains there, this is like God's country. I mean, I know I'm biased, but this is like my home, right? I love it. Otter Creek, you know, just to name one, it's the first stream. My daughter caught a brook trout on the fly, you know.
That's awesome, buddy.
I mean, dude, this is it. And it's like, you're living.
Yeah.
So that's my home. That's my home turf.
Yeah.
I'm doing all sorts of stuff. If we have time, we should talk about some of the stuff we're doing on the main stem Potomac, you know, for bass fisheries.
Absolutely.
You know, that's as well. And that links into some stuff, big picture stuff on climate change.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, just from today, I could give you a little rundown. I have one of the greatest jobs. I feel really blessed here.
Yeah.
You know, do what I'm doing here with is a fisheries biologist trying to do relevant work. But I'll tell you, today was a good sample, and now we could go through it. There are a couple big things that happened today that touch on these big projects.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, man,
AI is one, man.
Yeah.
But also, this two-way street, I just want to be clear about this for you and everybody who's listening. I mean, I need to learn from y'all, and that's one of the main themes you're going to hear from this, you know, especially this AI business, because this is all about angler-powered data. This is all about that.
So, yeah, absolutely.
I look forward to picking your brain too.
Yeah. Absolutely. No, yeah, man. I love it. And that's one thing that I think why I was so attracted to, you know, your presentation, what you were talking about, and it was not just the AI part, but it was the the angler participation, because that's one thing that I'm a huge advocate of, that I believe that if we are going to make a difference as anglers in whatever category that you want to, you know, you want to talk about, whether it's conservation, it's the ecology, it's, you know, just, you know, keeping the environment clean, keeping the air clean, keeping the water clean, that all starts with an individual, but that individual then has to gather people around him. And it takes a lot of like-minded people moving in a direction, moving, you know, forward in a direction to get things done. And, you know, in the system in which we work with our government, and you know this, working for the USGS, things move slowly, but the squeaky wheel often gets the grease first. And if we as anglers can do a good job of being a squeaky wheel in a very respectful way, in a way that helps to constitute, not only are we anglers, but conservationists and responsible people, those are how we get things done. And so the system in which that you're building out, and we'll talk about it here in a minute, it's that angler participation. It's that gathering of like-minded people together to make a huge difference that may not happen in a year, but in 15 years and 20 years from now, we're going to be doing things that could literally save streams and rivers and lakes from the climate change and everything that's going on. And it's just, it fascinates me. Absolutely fascinates me.
Look, that's great context, man, for real. And if you look at the history of the, you know, from the big picture, American history and wilderness movement, wilderness conservation, anglers and hunters had such a fundamental role with that. And now you look at the funding for conservation work at the state level and the federal level, anglers and hunters. Hunters have a big part of that. Now, we do see some scary trends in terms of, you know, licenses in some places. And I'm that's something else we could talk about.
Absolutely.
But we need to get more people out there on the water and you know, 100%.
Absolutely. So let's dive right into it. Let's kind of get into, let's just go with the climate change thing. It's kind of what's on my mind right now. It interests me very much. What, in your opinion, in kind of data collection you've seen, research that you've done, where are we with how climate change is affecting fishing, you know, fish populations and waterways, and how is it going to affect the angler? You know, not to be super, you know, like it's like, hey, let's just think about the angler, but we all are anglers here. Like, what does it look like for the angler, and what's it look like for the fish?
Well, I can tell you, you know, the work that I've done focuses on the smallmouth fishery in the main stem Potomac as well. But listen, this paper is actually coming out any day in the Transactions of the American Fishery Society. It's a great journal published by AFS. And the story is this, that in Shenandoah National Park, you know, one of the best Blue Ridge trout, brook trout fisheries that's around, but one of the last best places in my humble opinion, we do see some disturbing trends in places. We see populations declining where temperatures are increasing. That's, I mean, this is happening, and it's happening in our lifetimes. This is the part that really blows my mind, because we can talk about, you know, why brook trout are worth, I mean, what's so cool about a freaking brook trout? I mean, I love rainbow trout fisheries. I love brown trout fisheries. You know, this is great. Let's do it. But there's something extra special in my mind about native brook trout, because they have been here through millennia. I mean, they have seen glaciers come and go, and not over them, but, you know. Otherwise, it's sushi. You know, they can grind them back. But for real, dude, they've been here so ancient. They're ancient fisheries. That's one of the things that's like, respect your elders. Well, here's one of the elders. It's this mountain fish that's been here forever. That's amazing to me. So that's, you know, that's one of the motivations there.
Yeah, that's interesting.
This paper, I want people to check this out. It's it'll be available at, you know, Transactions AFS. Google it. And Evan Childress with the National Park is the lead author on this. Fantastic biologist out here. They've been collecting data in the National Park, in Shenandoah National Park, for, you know, several decades. And this is the first time we've been able to look at a trend in a population in abundance, because, look, these are boom-bust populations. We all know this. Some years big, some years small. That's natural variation. But when you actually see a big trend on that, it tells you that the trend, the real trend, is significant. It's a massive decline. So we're losing our fisheries there in places, and that's disturbing, because we can't attribute this to land use or other sorts of changes, dude. That's atmosphere talking right there.
Wow. So what's the change? Like, what is the rate of change that we're seeing, as far as, like, how could we quantify this for somebody, like in a temperature range, or what are we looking at there?
Yeah. So 68 Fahrenheit is a sort of, you know, a real threshold, and 20, it's 20 Celsius. That's a real threshold we look at all the time. And it just, stick your thermometer in the stream. I mean, that if you see that, we know that for a brief period of time during the day, you know, trout can deal with it if it cools down way below that at night. But that's a physiological threshold, man. The fish start getting pretty, you know, nervous. They start putting out a lot of stress hormones at that level.
Yeah.
They can tolerate a little, but not a lot. So we look at that as sort of a benchmark.
So to reiterate, so people understand this, because we did talk about this when I had John Hammonds on as our fisheries biologist about the trout. Mm-hmm. Trout don't handle warm water well. They're not a species like a bass. Like a bass is very adaptable, and it can live in a wide range of water temperatures. Trout, on the other hand, folks, you know, like Than just said, 68 is your threshold. Anything above that, they just start stroking out. I mean, they just cannot handle that stress hormones. They start dying. They start those kinds of things. So when you're talking about, in particular, like that paper that's coming out, you know, what are the trends that we're seeing as far as trending up? Like, what were temperatures, you know, before, and what are they now, and where do we think they're going? You know what I mean?
Right. So, you know, that's a big picture question. I should say that the work in Shenandoah there's a little bit more to it. Some places are stable over the 40 years that we've looked, and those are the bigger watersheds. They tend to be the, you know, larger stream systems, bigger populations. So that's a good sign. And also there's another part of it, which is that we do see increases in some of these watersheds, and it looks like it's a signal of reduced acid coming into from the atmosphere. The acid deposition seems to be getting better because we see rebounds in places that are not buffered. In other words, like places that can't handle a lot of acid getting dumped in from sulfur dye, from smokestacks and stuff. And so it looks like there's some good news there. I mean, we do see rebounds in some places, but you know, the big picture for anglers is that the brook trout streams in the last best places are decreasing, and it's happening. We're seeing losses of fish in places that we need to understand. And you know, in fact, we need to be monitoring these things closely, because right now, you know, I'm not worried about some of these streams because I think it looks stable, but I'm worried about others.
Yeah.
What makes me worried about the places I think that are most vulnerable, and our work does show this, is that places that have little groundwater coming in, they're very kind of sensitive to air temperature. We can do stuff with temperature data that, you know, basically helps us understand which places are sensitive to air temperature and which places are resilient. And the places that are, you know, very sensitive to air temperature are a concern. I'll be honest. I mean, we've seen losses of brook trout in places like upper, you know, Catoctin Mountain Park, in places in Maryland that are blue ribbon fisheries. But in our lifetime, we've seen those losses. Now, I don't want to be all doom and gloom about it, because there are other signs of optimism. And you know, we see great brown trout fisheries in Maryland, and those are stable. And we also see expansions, opportunities for expanding those, working with landowners, you know, to do, you know, pond work and you know, all that nitty gritty stuff. I mean, groups like Trout Unlimited out there on the land doing great work, and we're trying to help them, you know, get oriented and do the right stuff.
Yeah. That's interesting. That's very interesting. Yeah. And it's one thing one thing that I find when I'm talking to people, you know, when I'm talking to the public about issues and about, you know, like the climate change issue and all those things, I think when you try to tell people, like, you know, Upper Shenandoah, you know, unless you live there, it's hard for people to kind of grasp, like, why is it important? Or if, you know, a small species dies, you know, brook trout, that's not a small species. I mean, that's a species that a lot of people know about. There's a lot of investment into it. But like, you know, you're talking about different kinds of snail darters and darters and, you know, smaller species. And I tell people all the time, and it's basic science, like it's basic elementary school science. You know, you get your food web, and you start taking out too many pieces of the food web, and guess what happens to the food web? It starts to collapse, and that's not a good thing. And that's what the climate change is doing. And, you know, and I see it, and I struggle here. I guess conceptually, I'm still trying to wrap my mind around, like, climate change, what it is, huge picture, you know, and like looking, you know, there's so many different inputs out there, and then so many different people talking so many different scientific ways about it. But at the core of what I see in my anecdotal experience in my life is that weather is crazier than I've seen it ever. Things are warmer, but when it does get cold, it gets like really, really cold. It's extremes. It's not these, you know, these slight changes. It's these massive, you know, massive shifts back and forth. And it has hurt fishing in some ways, and then other places, like you said, you do see benefits, but it's because you see these boom bust populations. Like, you know, it's like Texas right now. Texas is fishing better than it's ever fished, and it's because we had a couple years ago, you had this big freeze in Texas. You had this extreme cold that killed a lot of fish. Well, now all these remnant fish that remain, you're having this massive, almost founder effect in some of these lakes, and they're growing massive because there's not as much competition. But there's going to be a downslide of that. And it's like, I think as anglers, we need to understand that, like, just because in our anecdotal experience as anglers that we see good or bad doesn't mean the whole is good or bad. And we got to look at the overall arching trend of where we're going and what's happening, right? Yeah.
Humility. I don't know. We can't do that. Yeah. We can't do
it. It's hard, man. It's hard to wrap our little human hundred, you know, if we're lucky, we get 70 years and our little egos have a hard time of seeing like what's going to happen in the future and why it's important. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. Well, I mean, that's for real. I mean, the analogy I like is you're flying in a plane, you're taking out bolts. Maybe one doesn't, you know, take you down. Maybe that one of them's going out, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, yeah. So I think that's all part of it for sure. I think there's also an economic aspect of this. I mean, you know, recreational fisheries are a huge industry. Let's face it. I mean, you know, and you take that off the table in ways. In the Potomac mainstem, I mean, so most of my experience is in sort of for smallmouth bass is in the mainstems, you know, Potomac mainstem space, or thinking about what we've seen on climate change there. Mm-hmm. I mean, extreme weather is creating more flooding in the springtime when those eggs and larvae are vulnerable. Yes. And we do think that's a pretty strong driver. So we've seen losses of juvenile smallmouth bass in the upper Potomac River for many years. We haven't seen a strong year class come through. But what we have seen is a lot of spring high peak flows, like massive scouring flows in that critical period. And so that's when, you know, look, that's not a good thing.
No,
I mean,
no,
but I don't think it's a bad thing either. You know, and again, we zoom out, let's look at Mother Nature knows better than we do. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And so a couple of years like that, interesting about Texas, by the way, I didn't know that, but you know, bad year is not bad. You know, it's like, there's good, it's a rebound thing. And that's the sort of like bigger than our every year. But the problem is this, when we have 5 years of extreme weather back to back, and this is what you're mentioning, we've seen evidence for this in the Potomac where we look.
Yeah.
It's what used to be rare is now common. So that's the problem. Right. Mm-hmm. Rare events are becoming more common. We see this. USGS, of course, has the flow gauge network. Fantastic, you know, gauging of river levels. And there's evidence for increasing variation. So it's like, and this has implications for fisheries too, man, 100%. Like, you can think about it this way. We see evidence for this again in the upper Potomac. There's some fish that capitalize on live fast, die young, right? Yeah. These are the opportunistic strategists. People call them weedy. Whatever.
Yeah.
These little guys that can produce like a clutch of fish and like, you know, like boom, boom, boom. If some disturbance comes through, big deal. They keep going.
Yeah.
Other fish, and then this includes smallmouth, you know, and also some of the catfish that are more like few eggs, big eggs, that you know, parental care. Those guys that are, they rely on stable conditions, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's interesting, but we do see booming populations of some of these native fishes in the Potomac that only make it when there's more extreme weather, when there's more extreme flows. They're doing great. So it's not like a wipeout for fisheries. The question is it a wipeout for the stuff we care about? You know?
And I think, you know, again, anecdotal to me, one thing we see living in East Tennessee, you know, living in the Southeast, TVA system of dams and lakes and rivers and things like that. TVA was established for a couple of reasons. First reason was flood control. Second reason was electricity production, so that, you know, we could do the Manhattan Project over here in Oak Ridge and all the different things that we did, right? And in that, one thing that I've noticed is, you know, obviously the system's set up to remediate flooding. More now than ever before have I ever seen, we have to drop the lakes lower than ever. And it's because we're getting so much more rain and flooding in the winter. I mean, right now it is piss pouring the rain at the house, and we've got a massive amount of influx of rain, and there's flooding that happened. Saw in Gatlinburg, it floods like that, you know, the big flood that they had, things like that. And so I think, you know, like you said, I think it's not going to be the small variations. It's going to be when it becomes more extreme that we see a bigger issue. And I think some of these lakes around here and some of these rivers are hurting because of that. It's an extreme amount of water that's flowing through there. It's mm-hmm. displacing habitat. It's displacing food for these fish. I mean, and at the basis of everything, a fish has a bass in particular has to have food, and then it worries about where it's going to live. As long as the food's there, then they'll find somewhere to live. And the thing is when you take both of those things away, you see decline in bass population, mm-hmm. decline of bass living mm-hmm. in certain areas and those kinds of things. But one thing I do want to ask you is when you look at like the Potomac or any river system, how many year classes of fish have to be disturbed before we see a population level effect? Like when do we start seeing that, or do we ever start seeing that? And is that a concern?
Yeah, good question. Well, you know, it varies by life, the longevity of these fish, right? Mm-hmm. So each species has its sort of, brook trout, for example, a pretty quick twitch there. I mean, they're, mm-hmm. you know, a three-year-old brook trout's an old fish.
Gotcha.
Smallmouth, you know, five or so is, you get up there. But anyway, that's your kind of window. You can only handle 5 years of that kind of stuff if you have it, depending on the adult mortality rate and all that.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what we look at, you know, longevity.
Yeah.
I mean, another thing is look down slope, look down at the blue cat. You know, the rapid change that's all over the landscape out here, you know, these guys are longevity. And so, yeah, change is afoot. I mean, anywhere you look.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, that's interesting, and it's like I almost I'm sitting here, my brain's working. Than you'll notice, like if you ever go back and listen to other podcasts, when I have people on that say very interesting things to me, my brain kind of almost like has to shift gears a little bit to wrap my head around what you just said. But like, I think it's just interesting. I think it's a conversation that bass anglers and anglers mm-hmm. all alike need to hear, and they need to be a part of, and they need mm-hmm. to understand. Because one thing I do wonder, and if you've had any experience with this, I'd love for you to share. So one of the big issues in Tennessee, North Carolina, it's going to start creeping up your way from what I'm hearing very soon, is mm-hmm. Alabama bass intrusion. You know, it's a very invasive mm-hmm. species, the Alabama spotted bass, very invasive mm-hmm. species. One thing that the Alabama spotted bass does that even smallmouth and largemouth have trouble doing is they are way even more adaptable than a smallmouth and a largemouth. Mm-hmm. Do you think that changes in, you know, overall temperature, not only in the air, but water, streams, rivers, and that in combination with these extremes, you know, flooding, extreme warm, extreme cold, and the Alabama bass's just pervasiveness, their ability to adapt. Do you think that that is lending almost a hand to Alabama bass being as effective as they have been in some of these fisheries?
I'm gonna have to punt a little bit on that because my direct experience is more in a different system, but it's analogous to this.
Yeah.
I mean, here's how I'd approach the problem is mm-hmm. that there, you know, we have some certainty about the thermal tolerance mm-hmm. Of all these species, mm-hmm. but those are overlapping. I mean, there's, mm-hmm. you know, you look at any one of these studies and mm-hmm. there is a range. Mm-hmm. So when people interpret like thermal tolerance of this, put some guardrails on that. And so when you do that for all those species, you start to see, well, there's more uncertainty than you thought. So, mm-hmm. you know, the way I'd approach it is to try to do some experimental work to look at thermal tolerance. Mm-hmm. I do run a stream, experimental stream lab up here at the Kearneysville USGS lab. And we kind of do some of that, mm-hmm. that kind of work. Now I haven't done this with this cast of characters though.
Yeah.
I can say the problem though, you know, let's look at the argument of both. Here's an argument. Like what we need here are fisheries that are resilient to change.
Mm.
Right. Mm. That's like evolution 101. Right.
Mm-hmm.
and change or die. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So you've got options, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is one way to look at it. But now the heritage and sort of legacy strength, like that to me is something that's takes priority in certain cases. Now, you know, we should be thinking about, you know, place specific strategies for such things, because there's that, and then there's also the fact that reality is you're talking about control of sort of fish movement, in some of these main stem rivers. And we've known that every time we've tried. There are only a handful of success stories here. They're mostly failure stories when it comes to controlling big river fish movement. So and you know, there's that reality behind it all.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. And that is one thing that I think we as anglers, there's definitely a divide and a misunderstanding is, you know, so I'm a big proponent of let's stop Alabama bass. There's a whole other population of bass specific anglers who are a big proponent of let's move them around and put them in as many fisheries as we can, because they don't understand the long-term effects of what's going to happen. They don't understand that, yes, you're going to have this, again, referring back to almost a founder effect. You're going to have a massive boom in population. You have a massive growth in size. They're going to eat a lot. They're going to get very big very quickly. And, yeah, you're going to catch 6, 7, 8, 10-pound spotted bass. And it's going to be really cool for a few years. And then all of a sudden, you're going to go, what happened? Now they're all 12 inches. And it's like, that's, you know, that's the science behind it. But like you said, it's like, you know, I think when we think about it, there's almost an ethical conundrum that we have to play with our own minds, and as well as, like, you know, we are a species on this earth that's been here for a long time, and we have had an effect on this earth in a way that no other species probably ever has. And so do we make the earth adapt to our changes, or do we try to stop the changes that we've made to make the earth function in its natural way? And it's, so it's like you got to ask yourself these weird questions.
I didn't know we were going this deep. This is fantastic.
Yeah, dude. So you got to, you got to ask yourself, do we stock the fish that are going to last through our change, or do we try to stop the change and try to preserve what we have? And for me, and I think for you and for a lot of anglers, it's like, man, I want to keep what we've got, because what we've got's really badass. It's like a brook trout. Like you said, this is a species that is ancient. You know, and I mean, it's been here long before we got here, and there's almost a reverence you have to have for that. And I just think some people don't have the reverence, and I think a lot of it just has to do with a short-sighted ignorance. But anyway.
Okay, so I think this is important. We're not going to stop trying to preserve mountain brook trout no matter what, you know. Absolutely. Like, that's what we're going to keep. It's not either or, right? We do both.
Yeah.
And you know, it's there are a lot of challenges. I mean, my hat's off to what the state DNR biologists are doing up and down the Appalachians on this stuff. Really, it's absolutely, it's impressive.
It's fascinating. It's fascinating.
And not just the DNR guys. I mean, it's like the there's a whole infrastructure of people out there on the land, you know, actually doing this stuff. TU, big partners and all that, you know, fantastic work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So let's get into kind of where you're researching currently, what you're working on as far as your AI projects, because they are absolutely fascinating. And I think
give me an update. This is work in progress. And this is, I can give you an update. I'd appreciate your feedback on this stuff. But we do have this project we are launching. This is a little like a look behind the curtain. We're going to launch this thing here this spring. And I'm really psyched about it. This is a huge partnership with USGS, with the nonprofit sector, with you know, folks and all across, you know, different institutions. So we're going to be launching this thing, you know, and we were looking forward to seeing people use it, put it to use. The name is Trout Spotter. Mm-hmm. And the idea is this: we're developing a tool anglers can use their cell phone to identify individual fish.
Yep.
That's it. We're starting with trout, and we're going to start. It's not going to be, the version 1.0 is going to be in a couple of places across the country. You know, we could talk about the specifics there. Mm-hmm. But you know, before we do that, you know, here's the partnership, which I think is so cool, because our motivation is, it starts with this, like, no, we get it. Like, no single institution, no, you know, DNR or federal or private or state, you know, anybody could actually get the data that we need to actually have informed decisions about fisheries management, conservation. Mm-hmm. It's just not going to happen. We get, like, there's too many places. And we're also limited by, you know, we don't have enough observations to say anything intelligent about all these places we care about. Mm-hmm. So this is our motivation to actually, work with the anglers, right?
And yeah, absolutely.
You guys are out there all the time, and you know, I'm out there as well. But the question is, when I'm out, am I really contributing? I mean, it's awesome. I might, you know, take a note. Yeah. But I'm not really contributing anything. Here's a way to actually contribute back to some specific objectives. So Here's the big picture. Anglers take a picture of the fish with their phone, and this is what we're focusing on. Obviously, trout. So it's going to be, you know, based on rainbow, brown, and brook trout is primarily to start. And these fish go into a pipeline, and this pipeline learns that individual using some AI technology, basically like facial recognition. This stuff is everywhere. I mean, honestly, you unlock your phone, it's sort of the same math under the hood right there.
Yeah.
But we identify individual fish. Some old timers have been doing this. I mean, it's so cool. You see guys like, oh yeah, look, I caught, this is my brown trout, circled these spots. And like this, a year later and you circle. Yeah. This is awesome. And I love seeing that stuff, but you know, those are the super hardcores. Yeah. And so we want to make this available to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the idea. So the picture goes in, launches through a pipeline, gets a prediction, an individual ID. So it goes, there's a training section where this individual's learned through his spot patterns. And then every time a new fish is captured, it's like, is that the first individual? You know, is that the second individual? Mm-hmm. And what the angler can get from that is a deeper sense of understanding of, like, you know, this fishery, their resource.
Yeah.
We will be reporting back to anglers, like, here's, you know, here's what the data you provided actually did for this place.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We can estimate abundance, movement for sure.
Yeah.
And hopefully estimate survival rates. So all this stuff is, it could be a game changer, honestly, you know.
Yeah.
So I think there are a lot of things that are happening there. It's still obviously a work in progress. This is early, right?
Yeah.
But when this thing launches this spring, I'm going to send you the info. I'd love it if you could push it out to the crowd.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, yeah. So, I mean, just to clear some things up for people so they kind of understand, you know, exactly what you're dealing with. So it's going to be an application or a program. This program is going to be under the hood is an AI. And it's unlike a large language model. This is more of an image based AI that learns images and can compare images 1 to 1 or 1 to 1,000. It's able to go through them and identify individual marks.
Right.
Person catches a fish, take a picture of the fish. They upload it to this application. So, you know, the AI goes, hey, this is a new fish, and plugs in the database. Or it goes, hey, I recognize this fish based off this unique spot pattern, and this is where this fish was caught before. This is who caught it, where it was caught, when it was caught, and then it compares it, takes all that kind of metadata that your phone's already storing on there anyway, and goes, this is where it was caught again, who caught it, when it was caught, all that kind of stuff, collects all that data. And so essentially what you guys are looking to do, and again, first iteration, but it only gets better, right? Everything gets better. It's technology. We're out of the bell curve. We're exponential straight up. We're going to the moon at this point. I got a feeling there's going to be a robot cleaning my house here in about 10 years. But anyway, I don't know if we're that close, but anyway, so essentially when it does get better, this is I won't say easy because there is a lot of complicated, you know, under the hood work that's happening, but it is a much more efficient way of data collection as far as, like you said, fish population, movement, water, air temperature, weather, all of those things that kind of conglomerate into data collection for helping in the conservation of fish.
Let's face it. We can think about some of the possible applications here. I mean, one of them is, you know, just where do my fish go? You know, like, like what? That's interesting. But there's obviously, you know, a bigger picture, places that you care about. Yeah. I mean, think about the cost and the energy and the time and expense it takes. Maybe some anglers out there, occasionally you'll get that, you know, that Floyd tag. It's like, bam, you know, call in. Maybe some states have programs like that, and it's awesome.
Yeah.
That is so rare. Like it's just so rare that we don't get good information about, you know, anything. I mean, not enough. So, you know, this is kind of revolutionary. And I also think it's super interesting that this puts some power in the hands of anglers that, you know, they haven't had before. I think that's interesting, and it kind of a useful application of this, you know. I mean, we, like I said, the NASA stuff with the TI instruments, like, That was like high tech 50 years ago.
Yeah.
We have tools we have never had.
Yeah.
And I think if we have to, you know, as outdoors people, you know, as anglers, conservationists, we can't let it control us. We need to be using it intelligently, but also, you know, I want to, you know, recognize it, that there's possible, you know, trade-offs, right?
Absolutely.
Linking our collection into like, oh, you know, I want to pull out a phone. You know, I'm just like, I'm catching a fish. But the fact is, most anglers are doing this anyway, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I know, and we talked about this on the bus ride, and you kind of dived into the Fish Brain app and talking about like what we thought of it. Little did I know at that time he was farming me for my information. I'm just kidding. But no,
burning
like
spots.
Yeah, that's right. It's burning spots, and that's what we worry about as anglers. And so, from your perspective, and like kind of since you're the one kind of heading this up, building it, how can you either alleviate and or just kind of address like spot burning with this sort of thing?
Thank you for that question. It's a good, great question. So for this application, we're not going to share location data publicly. We just can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not shareable, but there is a research grade where we're like, okay, doing stock assessment, mm-hmm. Abundance estimation, mm-hmm. help DNR, that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. That's research grade. And we will provide reports that will be for this watershed. Here's an estimate of X, Y, or Z, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But we take it seriously. And I think the best, you know, our team agrees that for this, you know, app, we're not really going to make location data public whatsoever.
Yeah. No, that's awesome.
Like, and then, yeah. That long. It's a choice, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think it's important, right?
Yeah, it is. And it is important. And I think that that's really cool. I think that that's where you show yourself and the research team. It's a responsibility to the technology that we have, right? You know, it's like that. It's like in Jurassic Park when Ian Malcolm says, what's he say exactly? He says like, you did it, but you never stopped and asked yourself, should we do it? Right. And, so there's like a responsibility there. Not only did you guys do it, but then you stopped and you asked yourself, should we do it? And then how do we make it as effective as we possibly can with also keeping people's privacy at the utmost importance to what we've got going on here? And that's awesome to hear.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, it's a good point. I mean, technology for its own sake. I mean, let's face it, you know, like angling is, it's like, that's deep roots experience.
Yeah.
The last thing we want to do is make it over tech. Now, this is where we got trade-offs, right?
Yeah.
We got forward facing sonar. We got it. Yeah. We're looking at our apps. We're doing our phone. We got all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, it's understanding habitat. It's understanding all the basics, like a drift line. Like that's where I think that I love gizmos, man. I have got so in my lab, I've got so many gizmos and stuff. Oh, yeah. It's great.
Gizmos, ladies and gentlemen, we as modern anglers have got a lot of gizmos, to say the least, especially if you're running a modern boat or a modern kayak. I mean, we are modern anglers in a modern world, and in a modern world, there's one constant. We need power, whether it's power in your phone, power in your truck, power in your boat, power in your kayak, whatever it is. We demand power in our modern lives. And if you're an angler that demands power like I demand it, you need to check out X2 Power Batteries, lithium to AGM. They've got you covered, ladies and gentlemen. I love my X2 Power Batteries, and I've loved them ever since I put them in my kayak and in my boat. I've been working with this company for 3 years now. And in those 3 years, there's been two constants for me. I've never had to worry about a battery issue, and I've loved every second of owning those batteries because I've never had a battery issue. As long as those batteries are charged, they are going to work. And like I said, lithium to AGM, they got you covered. Like me, in my kayak, I'm running the X2 Power lithiums. I got 250 amp hours that run my Newport motor. I've got a 20 amp hour that runs my Humminbird Graph. You go into my boat, you're going to find Blue Top AGMs to run my trolling motor and a lithium to run the rest of my electronics. And even if you pop the hood on my truck or my wife's vehicle, you're going to find Blue Top AGMs in there to start our vehicles. Guys, X2 is making the best batteries on the market. And whether you're an angler, you're into RVs, ATVs, they have a battery that's going to fit your needs, and you need to check them out. And I know what you're saying, Alex. Why would I go buy this battery if I'm only going to use it once a week or maybe once every 2 weeks or even once a month? You know, I don't get out very often. Well, here's the deal. The best battery that you'll ever own is the one that you forget is there. And that's the thing with X2 Power Batteries. Like I said, as long as they're plugged in, they're going to work, and they're going to be a battery that you can put in there, not have to worry about. And if you do have an issue, guess what? You go to a local Batteries Plus near you. You walk in, you say, hey, I need some help with this battery, and they're going to be able to help you out. And the cool part about a Batteries Plus near you and walking into the Batteries Plus is those dudes have been trained to help us anglers. They've been trained to understand the lingo that we talk. You know, if you walk in and say, hey, I got a Newport motor on the back of my kayak and I need a lithium for it, they're going to be able to help you to get the lithium that you need. And if you don't have a Batteries Plus near you, go to x2power.com, check out the battery calculator. You plug in all the needs that you have and it'll tell you the battery that you're going to need. And if you do either one of those things, and before you do either one of those things, write this down. It is RUDD X2. It's RUDD X the number 2, and it'll save you 10% off your entire battery purchase from X2 Power Batteries. Ladies and gentlemen, I love them. You need to go check them out. Great sponsor of the podcast, as well as just a fantastic product that I trust the Alex Rudd Fishing Experience to. Now, without further ado, let's get back into some modern technology talk with Mr. Nathaniel Hitt.
Yeah, no, yeah, I'm the same way, man. I mean, you're talking to a guy who straps. Yeah, you're talking to a guy who straps GoPros and cameras to his chest and walks around in the woods. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's this weird trade off, this weird conundrum that we have with ourselves as humans. It's like, how far are we willing to take this? You know, you look at Apple and their Vision Pro, and now you got people out in the wild with those things on, walking around, experiencing the world in augmented reality. Like, and it's again, you start asking yourself, like, what do we do here? But I think with what we're talking about here in particular, I think this is a responsible, very intelligent, very just good use of what AI can do for us. And so, like, well, obviously, you're starting with trout. That's iteration one. Question I asked you when we were in Texas and we talked about this, can we pass this on to other species, and like how effective can it be with other species? Yeah. So what is at the basis of what the AI is? So obviously it has to have some sort of pattern to go off, right? Some kind of almost, I wouldn't say binary, but very simplistic pattern to go off to be able to identify. What are the limitations of it? And then what other species can we expand into?
Yeah, good question. I mean, there is a big track record of this, particularly like in the terrestrial world, you know. I mean, it started with zebra stripes and then bear faces and all sort of charismatic, big critters, which is awesome.
Yeah.
In the marine world, the first work was done on whale sharks off the west coast of Australia. And if you think about a whale shark, you know, you see these point patterns, right? Yes. Very distinctive, like big circles. It makes a lot of sense, right?
Yeah.
And in that case, it was people diving, you know, like scuba diving and snapping photos and such. And what actually, you know, speaking of NASA, it was NASA's math that was this is version 1.0, right?
Yeah.
They were applying NASA's math down to the constellation of spots on these whale sharks.
So cool.
They're using, like, it was like this math is based on triangles, right? Yeah. Triangles are triangles. So
That's so cool.
That was the first approach. Now the new kind of version of sort of AI is, you know, in what people call neural networks, which is understood basically, you know, the analogy basically means, you know, it takes like an activation energy for a neuron to fire. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what the premise is of these models. And there's that plus doing many, many stupid things bajillions of times, then it becomes intelligent. That's also part of the magic of AI, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah, that's all very much, you know, exploding as we speak. But I think you're right on with the question, how do we use it intelligently for fisheries and conservation, right? Another part of the citizen science thing, I mean, it's not just anglers like contributing to the, you know, their favorite body of water, which is important.
Yeah.
It's also them contributing to, like, you know, larger efforts for research and conservation writ large. And let's face it, you know, we have to have a good public, you know, engagement as even the recreational fishing industry needs that.
Yeah.
For all sorts of reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's one of those things I preach all the time to my audience, you know, do simple things. When you go to the boat ramp, pick up some trash. You know what I mean? You know, go to your local, you know, meetings when they have a meeting about a fishery or a law change or a policy change. Mm-hmm. Go and sit in on those meetings. Participate. Let your voice be heard. You know, those are the things that as active anglers and conservationists and naturalists, I'll even say, that we are as anglers and hunters, it's important for us to do. But I think like this, when it does expand, you know, because you're talking to a bunch of bass anglers here. We're bass fishermen. It's like when we're at the science symposium, it's a bunch of bass and walleye guys, right? And so we're going, how does this affect us? Well, as this AI gets smarter, as it grows, as this
platform it grows as we get into version 2.3.4.0. I mean, you know, look at ChatGPT. We're at 4.0 already, you know, and this will be the same kind of deal. It'll grow. It'll get smarter. We start applying it to bass. We start applying it to walleye. We as anglers can do a simple thing, because we as kayak anglers in particular, you know, I fish from a boat and a kayak and from the bank. I do it all. I mean, if I can catch it, I'm going to go try to catch it. But kayak anglers in particular, and we talked about this, and I found this very fascinating. In a kayak tournament, we're already placing fish on a board to measure them and taking a photo of it anyway. There are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of photos backlogged already on Tourney X and all of these different apps that we use to submit photos to for our tournaments. Cool. And so if the AI can learn, you know, it can be tasked with and then learn, you know, patterns on smallmouth and largemouth and spotted bass, or, you know, head shapes or spots on the something, right? It's got to be, and this will be down the road, of course. This could be a humongous leap for understanding bass movement, bass behavior, bass habitat. I mean, it's all of these, I mean, things that, like you said, when we tag fish, we only get limited data. When you talk to anglers at a boat ramp, you only get limited data. I mean, like, and even anglers at a boat ramp, how many fish did you catch today? I don't know, maybe 9 or 10, maybe 9 or 15. It's like, well, man, that's not good, hard data. Whereas this could be, in citizen science, like you said, if you're willing to take that picture, if you're willing to do that with even 10 of the 15 fish that you catch of the day, that's 10 hard data points that can be
played. Well, I'll tell you what, that's good. And I didn't answer your question. I think that we should be optimistic about smallmouth and largemouth working for this tool.
Yeah.
For one reason, I think, is that I've been impressed with what we've seen with par marks off of salmon from Japan, a species called Masu salmon. What was impressive to me is that simply par marks, those big ovals on the side, particularly juvenile fish, you know, those are a thumbprint as well. And if those things give us information about individual identity, then the you know, wavy, you know, pigmentation on a smallmouth most likely will.
Yeah.
I also think for the record, I mean, look, striped bass fisheries. I mean, think about striped bass. You know, it's almost like you're going to scan it at a grocery store. Right?
Yeah.
It's an individual. So these, we're convinced now for certain brook trout, brown trout, rainbows, we've looked at, you know, that spot pattern is individually diagnosed. That's a thumbprint, right?
Yeah.
And so we're cool. Pretty optimistic as well about smallmouth. I think we should expect that to work. I can't say for sure because we haven't tested it, but I think we should be optimistic about that.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, you know, like you said, it's only version 1.0. And I mean, where we go from here, dude, I mean, there's no telling. I mean, the technology is only going to get crazier. And I mean, the phones are only going to get better. The resolution is only going to get better. I mean, it could get to a point with iPhone 20 and, you know, trout spotter or fish spotter, you know, 7.0 that there's no telling what we could do, right? I mean, there's just no telling where it goes and how it can be used. And I just want people to understand, like, where my optimism, and I think Than's optimism is like, this is truly first of its kind revolutionary tech that could change fisheries conservation forever, because it's a citizen science tagging program that has no limits. Only the battery in your phone and your willingness to take a picture is the only limit that it has. And like, if we can get people participating, we can get people understanding that this is a simple way to help conservation that's totally free, that's totally open to the public, that is totally based and driven by us as anglers participating, that this is the thing that we could truly leave our lasting stamp on fisheries conservation for forever.
You can say it better than I can. Absolutely, Alex. That's right. So here's the big picture. The partnership is this. Trout Unlimited is leading the charge. We expect the website's going to be, you know, tu.org/troutspotter. Yeah. So we land, we'll have all the information there, right? Yeah. Now, OnWater is the app. And if folks know OnWater, especially in the cold water fisheries world, OnWater is going to be doing the app that you download pictures to.
Yeah.
It's going to be a function within their app. And this is just kick ass. I mean, these guys are great. I mean, so the angler gets, you know, you can log your trips and all this stuff. We know these apps, how they work, but this will be a function within that. So that's great.
Yeah.
Trout Unlimited and OnWater just started this cool partnership. So expect that. That's That's a recent development for them. And I'm with the U.S. Geological Survey. So my piece is the like, okay, what do we learn from this,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
The other partner to mention is a really great AI conservation biology program called Wild Me. Okay. And they're part of this larger network called Conservation X Labs. Mm-hmm. These people are fantastic because they can actually build the AI pipelines to do some of the like heavy lifting. Mm-hmm. You know, as a fish biologist, I mean, I'm talking like today, for example, met with the University of Virginia Computer Science Department, yeah, thinking about AI and new development in yeah terms of, for example, thinking about fish length from images.
Yeah.
You know, wow. Pff.
Yeah.
It, you know, it's so the big partnership here is Trout Unlimited. It's on water, yep, for the app part.
Yep.
It's, you know, the U.S. Geological Survey and yep Wild Me. Yep. There are a lot of people that are involved in this partnership, but I think that makes it really cool. You know,
yeah, yeah.
We're going to launch this thing. It's going to be in four places for this first year. Now, you know, look, we're going to invite the world to be part of it, but we're going to start this four places this first year. The Rapidan River in Virginia. This is the Blue Ridge. It's a great big, you know, massive boulder system, fantastic brook trout fishery, yeah, up in the Shenandoah Mountains, Blue Ridge. I mean, this is one of the best streams out there. Widely loved. Rapidan TU chapters,
yeah,
involved.
Yeah.
Then we go to Maine, to the Rapid River in Maine, another epic brook trout fishery, but this is a much bigger river system. I mean, this is like, you know, you're talking like 20 meter wide river type, you know, big cold water,
yeah,
fishery there.
Yeah.
Then the Deerfield River in Massachusetts, a brown trout fishery with the you know, the anglers and are all on board. Deerfield TU is on board with this thing.
Yeah.
The outfitters are on board with this. So I think, yeah, we're going to see great that brown trout fishery in Deerfield.
Yeah.
And then University of Montana State University, you're going to be doing some work in the,
yeah,
Southwest rivers of Montana. So it's, yeah, going to be their, you know, brown trout, rainbow trout fishery. So people, yeah, are going to be participating from each of these regions.
Yep.
And then these core groups are going to go out, catch some fish. We're going to see how this thing works. And then I'm going to keep you posted because, look, this could be just a game changer.
Yeah.
It's disruptive technology, Alex, because, absolutely, you know, it could be, we could make it practically free to do things that we need to do everywhere that, otherwise would be impossible.
Yeah.
Impossible and you know, expensive in ways that we can't even imagine. So this really is that exciting space, but it's only possible when we, work with others. And, you know, I think bringing some of this tech to anglers makes a lot of sense. And you know, it's not everything. We still have to do basic 101, you know, habitat management, conservation. Absolutely. Like, this does not go away. But absolutely, I think, you know, this is a tool that could be a game changer, man.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'll give people first of all, launch date on this. So people know it's out in the ether. What is the launch date on this?
Spring of 2024. I can't give you a real date because there's too many partners and moving parts.
I love it. Spring of 2024. So sometime between.
I promise I'll let you know.
No, listen. And when it launches, we're going to do this again. But so one thing that people can go and look right now that is a great example of, I think what this is definitely akin to and what will be similar to, but not similar to in many ways, is the Merlin app. So the Merlin, mm-hmm, Bird app. This is something I love playing with that damn thing, dude. I sit on my front porch with it on and just see what's around me, right? And so for you guys that's never played with it, Merlin Bird app is an app. You pull up your phone, you hit a button, and it starts recording your surroundings, and it will identify bird sounds, and it will tell you what birds that are making those sounds. And so just like this app, it started as a research project. I forgot what it was at some college, but it was a research project they partnered with. Forgot who it was. It was one of the government entities. And mm-hmm, it was just the same basic idea of, here's this app, and the app just grew and grew and grew, and it continues to grow. And it's a citizen science based app that helps with data collection on all kinds of different birds. And so,
yeah,
you know, the reason I say that, guys, is if you're listening to this, whether podcast form, you're here live, whatever it is, you know, there's a good real life example of something that's out to go see kind of what Than is striving. I hate to say this, but just like what the striving toward or what we're trying to do here. It's just, we're trying to do it with fish. We're trying to do it with things that aren't as, like you said, it's not the megafauna and it's not the cute little birds that we all love. It's the slimy stuff that swims in the creeks that we all go fishing for. And
if they would all just pop out of the water and just scream their name every now and then, maybe we could use Merlin app for this.
But they don't do that.
I get you. I think that's a good analogy, you know, and I would say that what that app does, if folks know, is this sort of real-time information. It's like this bird, that bird, or the other.
Yeah.
We're not there yet with traps.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There's a longer, you know, there's a longer pipeline got to work through, but we've started something here, and I think that's a great analogy.
Yeah.
Right?
It's just
I think it deepens your understanding of how, you know, these places. I mean, ultimately, this is the vision is, boom, you have a real time. So you're talking about, you know, augmented reality. Well, ultimately, you can imagine a tool where you're scanning a fish, and in real time, it's, oh, this was George, right?
Yeah.
So-and-so caught this fish.
Yeah.
And maybe, like, you know, your friend caught. I don't know. That would be cool.
Yeah.
So like, that's the ultimate vision. But I'm telling you, the architecture, we're developing it now.
Yeah.
And math has been developed. It's a big team. There's a lot of people going, you know, and working on this stuff. But I think it's a really exciting team, you know. And what we hope to contribute from USGS is, let's actually start like doing stock assessment. Let's actually start doing stuff that we could never otherwise do.
Yep.
People are asking for it, but you know, places like the Potomac River Fishery for smallmouth, there's an opportunity there. I think you name it, there's an opportunity. Inshore fishing, the striped bass fishery.
Redfish with the dots on their tails. I mean, like all
totally.
So,
and the other thing is, by the way, just like a biological point here, is that we shouldn't be surprised by this because experimental work shows that, you know, these fish do see individuals. They can tell individuals apart, right? They learn by watching individuals. Brook trout has been, you know, shown experimentally. To actually observe fish interacting and then, changes behavior based on that observed interaction, which tells you that they do observe individuals. So, of course, those spots are individually diagnostic. You know, every time we think we're like we're doing something smart, Mother Nature's already done it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's one of the coolest things about these fisheries is like the ancient history of it. Like, come on, you know?
Yeah.
But it's fun to work on this stuff. And so, you know, there's obviously a long way to go, but, you know, this is a framework. And I appreciate your interest and stuff in this. I do. Yeah. We'll follow up as this moves forward.
Absolutely. Yeah, dude. No, it's really cool, man. And I do love to see it. And I think it's just one of those things. It is understanding that, yes, we're at the beginning of it, but the beginning of something that could, like we've been saying, I mean, it could change conservation forever. I mean, it's just such a cool thing. And I'm all about getting as many people involved in the system. And like you said, no one's asking for it, but I think it's because there's an ignorance level. And I say ignorance, not stupidity, because ignorance is just a lack of knowing. It's a lack of knowledge. It's an ignorance level to understanding we need that data. You know, that these state fishery or these state, you know, state agencies and the bigger, you know, federal level agencies. And I mean, like all of these things, they need the data and they're collecting it in probably some of the most efficient rudimentary ways possible. And this is just a different gear that could help us to collect it in a more efficient way. And that's all technology is, well, it's more than that, but at its simplest form is it's taking something that's hard to do and making it as efficient, as simple as possible. I mean, we went from the abacus to the calculator, you know, and then we put a calculator on a phone and now you can go, hey, Google, you know, what's 622 divided by 4 and it'll tell you, you know what I mean? And so it's just this progression of the simplification and you know, refinement of processes. And it's really
cool. I hear you. I agree. You know, but at the same time, you know, angling gets us back to our roots and we don't want to lose that. We want to stay grounded in that too. You know, so I think both these things are happening, but, you know, it's AI is this glitzy thing, you know, it's like, you know, all the hype. And I think it's deserved. Every time I think that an AI model cannot predict something, I'm wrong. So I'm just like, well, you know.
So tell me a little bit. I do have a certain level of intelligence, also a certain level of ignorance when it comes to AI. And AI fascinates me. It fascinates me, scares the shit out of me, but also fascinates me because, you know, you hear AI and some people it's like the Terminator music intensifies and they're all, you know, Skynet's coming. And then you hear other people and they're like, man, listen, AI ain't all it's cracked up to be. Where, you know, the truth often lies in between two extremes, right? In your experience with what you've been doing and messing with AIs, like, where are we with the AI technology? And like, is it, you know, it's this glitzy new word that everybody loves to use, but really at the core of what is it? What is it? Like for people, just layman's terms, what is it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a disruptive new technology that has good and bad wrapped up in it, but it's rapidly changing. I mean, we can understand a lot of the, you know, there's different jargon out there for different pieces of it, but actually a lot of it comes down to this idea of a neural network. And this is something we can actually understand, you know, I'm simplifying here, but they're inputs and outputs. Basically, you think about inputs being, you know, the things that you feed into a machine, like a picture or whatever, and the outputs being the things you want to predict, like, is this a cat or is this a fish or whatever? Is this individual one or is this individual two? And so, you know, the idea of neural network is basically the idea it takes a certain amount of information to fire that neuron. And so you think about a bunch of information moving through a network, and it takes a certain amount of activation energy. Well, you know, if you run that one time, okay, you run it 10 times, you run it 1,000 times or 1,000,000. And what you start seeing is that there's a certain pathway that predicts what you care about. And that's called training. So you're training, and that's the basically, you know, okay, it's just computer science. But yet that's the revolution in computing technology that made this, all the stuff hinges on it. So that's just kind of like a little peek under the hood there, as I understand it. But, you know, there's the interesting, you know, development in science that's, I think we see a revolution in science that is associated with what people call large language models. I mean, people are familiar with ChatGPT-4. All this is basically, we can understand this. This is just a model to predict the next word. Okay. So, you know, based on all the words prior, based on the training data, what's the likelihood of this next word? Okay. But there are applications even of that for conservation for fisheries. When we think about, you know, we were talking about at the, this today, actually, with colleagues at the University of Virginia, Department of Computer Science. You know, there are applications of large language models for building better predictions for fish ID. And, it, you know, that's just a one example of many, many. So, you know, I think that's fascinating. Another one to watch is this length and maybe weight estimates from images. So you're reporting that, you know, these tournaments, you're reporting fish on a board or fish on a scale. Well, okay, fine. That's a obviously the best thing you can do. You can do right now, which is pretty darn good. But if we can get estimates of fish length without even a fish board behind it, so that you could start reporting some of these lengths with confidence, it'd be a standardized thing. That technology is being developed right now. And yeah, we can expect that from several app developers soon. So, I mean, buckle up. I mean, this is amazing, right?
Yeah, it absolutely is. Yeah. It's fascinating. I got, it's funny, rabbit hole. I'm surprised we've not had a rabbit hole yet. We normally have a bunch of rabbit holes on this.
That's all I've been talking about.
Yeah. So, rabbit hole. Listen to Rogan. Rogan had on Social Network guy. Did you ever watch that documentary, The Social, or not Social Network, Social Dilemma? Did you ever watch that?
Remind me about it.
It's pretty much the guy just making, just pretty much telling everybody Facebook's evil and that Facebook gives you, feeds you what it thinks. So that same guy had a, they got a new documentary coming out about AI, and they were just talking about like AI's capabilities and kind of some, what are some of these bigger tech companies are working on, you know what I mean? And it was like scary in the fact that there was, and again, guys, everybody listen to this. This is not, I'm not against AI. I'm not for AI. I'm a neutral figure in AI here, just if taking in the information until I figure out what's going on. But this was scary to me. So this AI that I think Google had came up with, it, you know, the little captchas in websites. So you go to the captcha, it says, you know, hey, are you a robot? And so it, so this AI goes to this captcha and it recognizes, it goes, that's captcha. And like these Google engineers can see the internal dialogue that the AI is having with itself as it's trying to figure this problem out. And so it goes, that's a captcha. I can't tell it it's a I'm a robot because I am a robot. And then it stops and it processes and it thinks and it goes, I will say that I'm deaf, or no, I'll say that I'm blind, and I'll have it read the captcha to me. And so it told the program that it was blind. It read the captcha to it, and it inputted the captcha, clicked I'm not a robot, and it let it through the system so that it could get into the system and continue doing the task that they set it on. Now, these Google engineers were testing this. They were teaching this thing. And at that point, they said, no, can't do that. That's like literally, it's like iRobot with Will Smith, where it's like, you know, you won't hurt humans. Well, that was like one of those things where it's like, hey, we can't lie. We're not going to lie and do these things. But that was just something that... That was one of those that I went, yeah, the Terminator music intensifies in the background, and it's like...
Look, it's not crazy. I mean, let's face it, like, cameras are creepy. I think it's weird. I think that that technology, we have to understand it and be really careful about it.
Yeah.
You know, what makes the, you know, images, so you got a fish in the net, right? Hand net, boom. It's location services, which gives you a lat long.
Yep.
You need to be in charge of that. You need to set that when you want to set it and take it off when you want to take it off. I mean, we have to, that's only just the tip of the iceberg. I think, you know, honestly, when we carry around these recording devices all over the place, we ought to be concerned about this. But here's one of the things, you know, like, why angling? Like, why be outdoors, people? Like, why, you know, I think it's those, getting back to your roots again. This is one of the places we have to like keep it real. And so this is a way to do that. Now, forward facing sonar. I mean, we're putting the goggles on, you know, it's, we got apps, you know, at the same, I think we got to be just aware of that and intelligent about how we try to opt, you know, take the good and not the bad. You know, I think we can be selective.
Yeah.
But we got to be smart and look, we got to face the fact that things are changing rapidly. And, you know, we have to, like, you know, lean downstream. It's my personal motto. Like, as a whitewater paddler, I love that. Yeah. Lean down, you hit a rock, you know, lean, don't be afraid of it. Lean into it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So, that's, I think you and I can solve this problem. All we need is like two more minutes and we'll have it nailed. I mean, this is big stuff, man.
It's huge. It's existential is what it is. And I love your take on it that, you know, like, you are obviously a person who is dealing very heavily in, like you said, disruptive technology, but you're also a person who at your core is an angler, and the detachment away from the technology is, it's freeing for the soul. And I do tell people that all the time. You know, we went on a camping trip just this past week, froze my butt off. But we went to this little mountain lake, you know, just primitive campsites, no electrical hookups, no bathhouse, no cell phone signal. And that just detachment away from the modern world, the modern technology, it's good for the soul. It's good for the spirit. It frees you and makes you understand that, yes, technology is a beautiful thing, but it also is a very scary thing all at the same time. And that we as people, like you said, as existential as it is, we have to make and be responsible with this thing. I mean, and that's the thing is, like, I think that's what's so fascinating about it too, is go down another rabbit hole, is like, in my lifetime, 30 years old, I don't know how old you are, Thane, but I'm 30 years old. In my lifetime, I have seen us go from bag phones to iPhones. I've seen us go from desktop computers with dial-up internet to I'm sitting talking on a MacBook Pro that has a chip in it that literally is so fast it doesn't even, I can't even comprehend how fast it is. You know, I'm talking to you through a podcast board that literally 10 years ago, we would have had to have a whole damn radio setup, analog setup, to do exactly what this thing does now digitally. And it's like, I think where we are struggling with this is the exponential, almost existential thing that we are. It's like, we're trying to figure it out as fast as it's faster than we can figure it out. It's moving that fast. You know what I mean? And it's just,
well, that's a good point, but I'll tell you the other, you know, point of view, you know, from the work literally we were doing today in this paper that's coming out in AFS.
Yeah.
Things are changing fast out there too. I mean, our rivers are changing. Fisheries are changing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we see it. I mean, that blows my mind. I mean, the fact is, you think about like the, you know, glacier 35,000 years ago, like, you know, big old glacier parked here, you know, sitting north of, you know, Baltimore, you know, throughout Pennsylvania there, refrigerated this whole region. That's nothing compared to, you know, the bigger picture, but we do see changes in the last 40 years. Like, our data sets are limited, but we still see that. Blows my mind. Decreasing brook trout numbers in some streams. That is like, heads up, people. And then, you know, we do see failures of smallmouth bass recruitment, but no, we're not seeing huge year classes come through. Maryland DNR, I respect them, man. They do great work. They had to go to a supplemental stocking for smallmouth in the Potomac main stand. That was the first time they've ever had to do such a thing.
Wow.
And so I think, you know, we got to have strong, you know, year classes come through. We got to pay attention. Why? I think flows are a big part of that. There's more to the story, but, you know, the extreme weather.
Well, that's so huge. I mean, that's huge. Yeah. To reiterate that for people to understand, like, when you have to start stocking smallmouth, like, that's not a normal thing. I mean, because you're talking about a native species of very pervasive fish that do well and can handle quite a bit. I mean, you're not talking about a very sensitive fish. And so when you got to start stocking, that's proof of a big change that's happened. And that's crazy.
It's a situation. I mean, well, first of all, they're introduced in the Potomac, you know, a history of, you know, smallmouth coming in there. Almost all the big fish in the Potomac were introduced. I mean, it's kind of a crazy story because Great Falls of the Potomac is right there, sitting there as a big fish pad. It's like a natural fish passage barrier. So all the, you know, fisheries of the upper Potomac. There are these cool fish weirs up here, by the way. If you check it out on Google Earth, you'll see these in the upper Potomac River. Those are fish weirs. Those are Native American fish weirs. They're still there. I mean, that's blows
my mind. We got those down here, and you can still catch fish off of them. It's crazy, dude.
That's so cool. And it's still good cover for it. I mean, it was American eel that we're harvesting primarily, which is something interesting to think about. American eel numbers they're actually rebounding in places like the Blue Ridge. If you take out the dams, like American eel show up. I've been snorkeling in the Potomac. I love doing this. We, you know, just like go diving. I've got a little sea scooter that's like remote. I like grab it, dive down and get under these big boulders and habitat and stuff and just hang out. And you're like, oh, flathead catfish, you know, like huge channel cat. Awesome. But recently saw an American eel. This thing was like a yard long. It was in this big woody, you know, like cover. Just kick ass, man. That was amazing. A huge American eel had come up all the way over as a juvenile, ascended Great Falls, got up into the river, boom, as a female. You know, she probably spent 20 years up there. That's the coolest.
Yeah, it is, dude. And that is a cool experience. I have that here. So there's a creek not too far from my house, and I've talked to many a biologist about this, and it still blows their mind, still blows my mind. But this lake or this creek, not even 2 minutes from my house, so Larry could walk to it, right? It is full of muskies and largemouth and smallmouth, but muskies in particular. The muskies that are in this creek, and I mind you, when I say creek, I'm talking average depth of 2.5 to 3 feet, maybe 15 yards wide at its widest point. The muskie that were in there, the only way that they could have got there is they were stocked in the lake that is 18 miles down creek. And these muskie have moved not only up near my house, but on up like miles and miles, tens and tens, 20s of miles up the creek. And they are, it's that same kind of thing that, like, you know, I went and fished that creek, put a kayak in there. I'm paddling up, throw a buzzbait on the bank and clack it about twice, and about a 30 inch muskie eats it. And I go, it's the same thing. You're like, dude, that's badass. Like, where did that come from? get here? You know, and that's the part of like angling that I love, you know, it's awesome.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, so, you know, once again, that those marks, they've got to be individually diagnostic. You could tell a story with that, and you know, you could get there with a photo. I mean, that's where we're going. You can get there, but I mean, these big migratory fish too. That's very interesting. Muskie in the Potomac is the big, you know, concern there is that summer thermal refuge. I mean, it gets pretty spicy on the Potomac main stem, and so they're sniffing out cold water, and they're. There are just a couple places. I mean, they're trib junctions, but they're also like groundwater seeps, right? A big, actually should mention this, big focus of our lab work is looking at that groundwater surface water interaction. Like that creates cold water for trout and for muskie, you know, that's the precious stuff. So anyway, we're trying to like predict out where those spots are. It's not just as simple as trib junctions. We're interested in that and doing some things like dragging temperature gauges with kayaks downstream and just like having a GPS on the top and then dragging these things, one's on the bottom, one's on the top. And so the difference between the temperature on that, you know, the one dragged to the water column and the other one banged across the bottom. That gives us real information about, like, hey, man, the thermal refuge. This is musky, sweet stuff.
So explain. So I understand what groundwater is. I understand where groundwater comes from. I get that. But, like, are there any concerns with groundwater warming up, or is groundwater kind of
unaffected by the climate?
Good question. Good question. It depends on the depth of the aquifer, right?
Gotcha.
Deeper groundwater aquifers. We have evidence for this. There's a great paper published 2 years ago, 3 years ago by colleague Danielle Hare, who showed that in places where the groundwater is deeper, we see stable stream temperatures. But in places where the groundwater is shallower, we see warming temperatures. So we think that that makes a lot of sense. And it's basically, you know, think about a big chunk of bedrock and then, you know, put smaller rocks on top of it. If water can't get through that bedrock layer, so we're looking at everything kind of in the recharge zone for streams, right?
Gotcha.
So the deeper that aquifer, the more resilient. And think about it, it's like a refrigeration unit, right? Yeah. All that rock contact.
Yeah.
But you point out, I mean, it does, groundwater temperature does vary with, you know, mean annual air temperature. It usually kind of tracks mean annual air temperature, but the deeper, the better. Yeah. I mean, this is the magic stuff for when we're trying to predict out, like, where will be the last, you know, native brook trout fisheries in Appalachia, for example.
Yeah. Yeah.
We look for places that are, you know, sourced by deep groundwater. It's not just spring creeks, but I'll tell you one of the surprises is that some of these low elevation spring creeks can actually be we anticipate being some of the last cold places, you know.
So
challenge there, of course, is that the habitat's hammered, you know, so you have that. But, big picture, there's definitely, you know, groundwater is sort of, it's hard to understand it in a way because you just see a stream like running. Yeah. But I'll tell you, when you do dye testing work and other tracer work, we see evidence of this, that you can have a full swap. The ground, that water can drop all the way into the aquifer, into the shallow aquifer, the shallow groundwater. And then it can come up and swap entirely with the water in the stream. And that can happen over like 100, you know, feet of stream.
Huh.
I mean, that there can be massive exchange of groundwater and surface water. So the stuff under your feet, you know, you're walking through a stream, that stuff that's happening under that rock layer can be super important. And also is important for where streams go dry, right?
Yeah.
We see places like a southwest chunk of Shenandoah National Park where we this last summer, man, it was, as you know, we saw epic drought and that affected fisheries for sure. It affected the smallmouth fisheries. Shenandoah is actually, they closed their fisheries because of some of the epic drought and dewatering. The streams that went dry, though, where the streams, the really shallow aquifer, that there was only a yard down until they hit like a bedrock layer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So very thin, you know, and those things went dry. And they also tend to be more sensitive to air temperature. So that's a recipe for, you know, climate, for a place that's going to be, you know, hit pretty hard by climate change. The other stuff, we saw streams were relatively cold. They were connected even in our drought condition. And so, you know, we're trying to learn from this stuff, right, to make some predictions for across the mountain range. But we've done a lot of detailed stuff in the Shenandoah National Park, Catoctin Mountain Park, up and down, you know, worked at the Forest Service a lot in the Monongahela. Just a lot of great partners out there.
Yeah, that's interesting. So when you say, I had a little bit of it, I'll be honest, when you said, this is a very passing phrase, but it kind of scared the shit out of me, to be honest with you. When you predict where will be the last brook trout stream, what are the predictions? When's it going to happen? So, you know, we've had, what, 4 major extinctions in the history of Earth, right? And, like, we're rolling up on the fifth one. When's the fifth one going to happen? They're saying, not to be very negative.
Yeah, I mean, people that work on, you know, biological diversity point out that that's happening right now, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, another thing about the Southern Appalachian streams and rivers. I mean, you know, you're from the South. It's like we live in one. If you look at a map of global biodiversity, like where are all the species on Earth? You see, rainforest, but you also see Southern Appalachians pop out. And it pops out, as you know, because the rivers and streams. I mean, it really is something special. And I think that, you know, the best work is where we align conservation strategy and, you know, angler, like improving fisheries for anglers, and do these things in like invest in conservation.
Yeah.
And honestly, I think the debates, you know, you could imagine like, okay, you got Trout Unlimited here and you got Bassmasters over here. They're just going to duke it out, you know?
Yeah.
But the fact is like, that's this and everybody else is way over. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But anyway, I think it's funny. I think the main thing is people that are focused on conservation and actually being outside and experiencing nature, you know.
Yeah,
that's the big picture.
It's just interesting to me. Like I don't know. I mean, it's an existential kind of question that I often, I'm an interesting human thing. I think a lot, and you know, when you're out on a boat by yourself for 8-9 hours, you do a lot of thinking, you know. And so I've gone down the rabbit hole of like, you know, especially like you said, Appalachia. I don't think people understand like Appalachia and Smoky Mountain National Forest, Cherokee National Forest. I mean, everything associated with those areas, the biodensity there is. I mean, there's nothing else like it in the world. I mean, rainforest, right? You know, other than that, like, there's nothing like where we live. And, you know, when I think about these big existential things like climate change and all of those things, deforestation, acid rain, all those problems that we have. And I think, you know, as insignificant as maybe the salamander is that's living under that rock, it's still something that I would love to be able to show my kids one day, you know, but saying that, what I want to know and what I want to hear, and this is what I always love to do, is what do you see as the biggest threat and what do you see as the biggest positive in your line of work right now? And what can we leave people with a good note on? You know what I mean?
Well, I appreciate that. That's great. So, you know, I the greatest threat, I mean, it's not a physical, it's human's apathy. It's people just not caring, people not being out, being engaged. Like, that's it. The other stuff follows from that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I could talk about like geophysical processes and population dynamics and thermal.
Floor's yours, buddy. Whatever you want to do, you let it.
I don't think that's actually. I think those are all secondary in that regard.
Yeah.
And you know, like what we're doing right now. I mean, I feel like people networking, putting pieces together, thinking creatively, bringing new tools to old problems, trying new stuff. Yeah. I think that gives me hope. That's what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
And you know, on a good day, I mean, I do have like a pretty awesome freaking job. I get to like,
you were telling me about a little bit of it. It's a badass gig.
Man. Yeah. It's a sweet gig. It's I get to on a bad day, I'm like pushing paper and it's like, you know, like junk, like y'all like. But on a good day, it's like we are solving the mysteries, unlocking the mysteries of the universe. And it's like for fisheries conservation and management.
Yeah.
Like, yes. Amen.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are, it's not like that every day.
No, absolutely. No, I love it. I love that, dude. I love that. Yeah. And I agree with you, man. That's huge. And that's something that there's been many times in the past few years that people have said very simple things to me and I went, well, yeah, that's it. And you're right about the apathy thing, dude. Like that's huge. It's humans' apathy in so many aspects in life, not just what we're talking about here tonight, like in everything. It's just like, and I think it's because we are inundated with so much information every single day. You know, your brain finally goes, damn, I can't do any more. You know, White House this, Ukraine that, Russia over there, climate change, fish, you know, everything. And you're like, I can't do any more information. But I think it's important for humans to, you know, as apathetic as we can be to certain situations, do find something, you know what I mean, to attach yourself to and let it be the thing that you try to affect in this world, you know. And I mean, I have a few things that I do, you know, and one of them's, you know, cancer and fighting back against cancer because my dad had cancer. One is conservation work and doing exactly what we're talking about tonight. You know, and I think that those two things are the ones that those are the hills I'll die on. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I love your attitude about the technology as well, because this is a perfect example right here. What we're doing tonight, this is a perfect use of very advanced technology that some people want to use for bad, but you know, by damned if we're going to do it, we're going to do something for good, and we're going to help move the world forward, and we're going to do our best trying to do it. But
well, yeah, and I appreciate what you're doing out here with this channel, man. Yeah, and keep up the good work too.
I will, absolutely. Well, listen, man. Once the app's up and running, I want to have you back. I want to pick your brain some more, buddy. I think, like I said, you're a fascinating human. I love the way that your brain works, and it's been a pleasure having you on here tonight. And
thank you, yeah. Thank you for letting me ramble to you with you.
Listen, what we'll do is next time you come back, we'll just do like a whole rabbit holes like edition. Like I'll just get like 15 things on a piece of paper, and I'm gonna be like, Bigfoot, what do you think? And let's go and let's see what happens. You know what I mean? Because I'm surprised. Usually on this podcast, we end up on aliens and Bigfoot at some point or another. I mean,
don't get me started on Mothman. Okay, please.
Hey, dude, Mothman.
Don't even.
Oh, Mount Pleasant, Mothman, man. It's real deal. But Than, is there anything you want to share with everybody before we end, or anything like where they can find you if they want to ask you questions, anything like that?
Just Google me up, and please reach out. You know, I'm interested in feedback. Honestly, this thing is a work in progress, and so we got a lot to learn from folks, especially as we design sort of like how do you know the instructions, how to roll this out, et cetera. Advice from anglers, man, it's like we need it. Yeah. And honestly, I'm open to it. Yep. So, you know, look me up. You'll find my contact info.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Than Hit, really awesome dude. Enjoyed having him on. As always, you guys are sweet, and we will talk to y'all next week. Bye.
Bye, buddy. Hope you find your dad.